My name is Nissa Heimers. I'm from the Netherlands, and I am a filmmaker and musician. And if I were stranded on a desert island and I had to take one movie, it would be Mulholland Drive by David Lynch.
48 hours to go. If you're looking for a hero, then this is the show. Where did they come from? What do they know? It's an origin story. Let's go.
All right, welcome everyone to 48 Hour Heroes Origin Stories. I'm your host, Kirk Nordenstrom, and I'm here with my little Dutch sister, Indra Van het Hooft. Hi, Indra.
Hi, everyone. Hi, Kirkie. My big brother from another mother. I am Indra, and I am a city producer here in the Netherlands for three beautiful cities.
So what are we talking about this week?
So it's interesting because this week was very special to me because we, as a guest, we have my best friend on, Nissa Heimers. What I know from him and what we touched on in the conversation itself is the importance of winning or the lack thereof. So, do you enter a 48 purely to win an award or don't you? Or do you enter because you want to create something? How is it on our end, having the judges' calls? And what weird entities judges can be.
Yeah. Well, it came up during our discussion. I kind of got the competitive thing out of me at a certain point in my life because I swam competitively for 10 years and I was good. I wasn't great, but I was good. If I'd have continued on into college, I probably would have been nationally ranked. I could have gone to NC2As and possibly final, but not won.
Wow.
You know, in the mile or the, 500 yard freestyle, all the NC2A stuff is all in yards, not meters.
All right.
Which is, bonkers, but there you have it. And as I got into college, I just wanted to be creative and weird and funny. And
so like you're now.
Yeah. When I got into the professional world, in my former life as a graphic production artist, I worked at Kinko's for a couple of years, working in the photo lab and in computer services, doing desktop publishing. Wow, that's a term I haven't heard in a long time. Desktop publishing. Doing page layout, and got into the temp world with a bunch of my buddies, and we all had functionally the same skill sets, and there were a lot of jobs out there, but we'd hear, oh, the Lenhart Group has a position open, and we all wanted that one because it was just a fun place to work. And the competitive thing kind of came out in me again, and It has since receded again. I think particularly because of running the 48 here in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've grown into a role that I'm just now really coming to terms with, is that I like to help people.
Right.
I don't really care for praise or credit to a deep degree. Of course, everyone wants praise and credit for their accomplishments.
Of course, you need that sometimes.
Yeah. You need validation for your work. Yes. But I'm finding I enjoy the 48, running the 48 so much because I get to help people.
Absolutely.
We have our friendly competition among cities. The next target is San Diego. I'm going to take down San Diego one of these days. But, Dwayne just keeps just a little bit ahead of me, and it's a good motivation. As we talked with Angela and David, the other week, is mm-hmm. David doesn't give a shit about the awards, and Angela's, she's very competitive. She's got competitive spirit. And I think there's a place for both mindsets in the 48.
Absolutely. I think, for me, when I still participated, I started out not very competitive because I knew that what we were making wasn't nearly as good as everybody else, so I wasn't going to win anything. But then, you know, we started to get better and win something here and there and get a nomination here and there. And that feeling, that like, it kind of lit a fire under my ass. And it's a big ass, so it's a big fire. Yeah. So I became very competitive. And I always went, no, you know, I do it for the fun and the creativity and the team building. And yes, absolutely, 100%. But when it came to actually standing there at the award show and not winning anything, even though I thought we made the best film ever, I would go up to the city producer, and to all of the city producers in the Netherlands I have done this to, I'm sorry, because I now know how it feels to be on the other end of this. I'm sorry for bugging you about the judging process, because what I think participants don't always know is how tough that is, for judges to pick a winner. Now, we had our production weekend last week, and I had my judges call yesterday and the day before. It took just over 6 hours, 3 judges and 14 films. They were great. We had one of them, actually, Thijs de Neve, is going to be a guest on the podcast in the near future. So watch out for that one.
Great guy.
Because he's going to have cool stories to tell.
I always look forward to seeing him at Filmapalooza.
Yeah, he's wonderful, and he's so knowledgeable. And you know, in the judges call, they were all very knowledgeable. But he has a very producer's view on judging the films, which is very interesting. But I think, and it's also something that Nissa says, you know, you start out with making whatever it is you want to make, and you go, I don't really care about the awards. I don't really care. As long as we make something that we're proud of and we're happy with and had fun doing it, it's all good. But when you're actually there and you see those awards on that table, on stage, you go, wouldn't it be nice if? And I think that is actually the best mentality to go into it. Because if you go into it by thinking, this has to be fun, we're going to make something we're proud of, and by the end of the weekend, we've created something, whatever it is that we created. And then you think about the awards. And I know you have teams that do it the other way. You know, they go, okay, what wins? What type of film wins? Let's make that. And I think that is kind of stifling your own
ability
and creativity.
I don't think anyone truly just says, well, I don't care about the awards. Everyone likes to get an award, but I think the motivation, you know, the most important thing is just getting out there and fucking doing something.
Don't wait, create.
Exactly. And, you know, you want to do everything to the best of your ability in hopes of being recognized. And I've seen it at screenings in the past where, you know, people were surprised at the outcomes, and I'll see one group from a team talking to another and saying, you know, oh, I really think you should have won. And there's a recognition in that Absolutely. I think is very important when you get the recognition of your peers.
And I think that's why the audience awards are so great.
Yeah.
Because that is the way. In the end, if you make a film, you make it be, and especially within the 48, I think, you know, you make something because you want to make something. But second place is you make something that the audience enjoys, that people enjoy watching, get a feeling, an emotion from, whatever emotion that may be. So if you win an audience award for your screening group, then that recognition of your peers, and usually, unless, what my experience is, unless there is one really fucking great film in there that like trumps everything else, it's usually the ones that don't do as well with the judges that do really well with the audience, because it's so bad it became good, or it was so funny and over the top but the judges went, ah, that's too much. And I think that difference is very interesting.
Yeah, and it's very, very rewarding for the filmmakers who do it. And there's something about being in the room too. My judges almost never come to the screenings, so they never experience the films with an audience, which can be a completely, completely different experience.
Absolutely.
I mean, we had this one film. It was early on in the Seattle 48, and it was about a kind of a middle-aged guy who was upset with his life, and he idolized a Seattle Mariners baseball team manager, Lou Piniella. And he just decided that he was going to live his life more like Lou. He was going to be like Lou. And so he started running his life as if he were a baseball team manager.
All right.
Production quality on it was not good. And the judges weren't going to give it anything. But people were cheering in the audience. And it won by this massive margin.
Yes.
And everyone was rooting for this guy. It was fantastic.
That's so special. Because yeah. I think, you know, we have, like, in any 48, anywhere in the world, any city, they're not always all good and they're not always all bad. There is a very big level in quality of the films that are being handed in, right?
Yeah.
So there's always a few better ones and a few not so great ones and then a whole bunch in the middle. And I think that if I look at ours, like, for instance, we have a team now that started, I think, like a few years ago, and they made something that wasn't that great, but it had so much potential.
Yep.
And they did really well in the audience voting. And now they go on to make something. I can't really say too much if they're listening, and I'm because, you know, I don't have my results out there yet, so I'm going to be very cryptic with this one. Sorry, people. But what they've made now is like 100% better. It is so good, and it's just the coolest thing. And it's kind of taken back on what you said earlier about helping people. I think the fact that we are able to facilitate something like this is, even though, don't get me wrong, people, being a city producer, it's not always fun. It's stressful sometimes. It's hard work, but it's so fucking rewarding to see people do so well and grow so much. And, you know, getting judges to say, oh, this is really great. Like, are these professionals? And they're all very young people just starting out.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that is just amazing. And I think Nissa, for instance, you know, he is a professional. He works in the industry. He's been an actor in the industry. He has so much experience and so much talent. And even though he won't admit to it, because he's the most modest guy you'll ever meet, but he is amazing. And his brain, I can't even. It's just wonderful. So for him to go, well, you know, I don't really care about the awards, but then they make something and they become, you know, runner up all the time. They're always a bridesmaid, never the bride, which is kind of funny. And now they're running gag. But they win writing and they win, you know, we made a musical a few years ago and we came in fourth out of 50 films. And, you know, so, and I think because he has his writing partner, Julian, because also Julian is going to kill me if I don't mention him, just like Nissa is going to mention later on. You know, they have this mentality of let's create something that we want to make, that we want to create, have fun doing it with great people, and we'll see where it ends up.
Yeah.
And that is a successful formula, if you ask me.
Yeah, I agree. People should really check out the bonus episode this week, because... It is geek fest.
It is geek heaven. Like, we go from Lord of the Rings to Community. Sam Raimi. In there.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sam Raimi. You know, it's geek fest galore. Yeah, so definitely go check out the bonus episode. But first, stay tuned for our conversation with Nissa.
All right. Enjoy.
It's an origin story. Let's go.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to 48 Hour Heroes Origin Stories. I am your host, Kirk Nordenstrom, city producer for Seattle, Montana, and the San Francisco 48 Hour Film Projects. And with me is...
I am Indra, and I'm the city producer for Arnhem, Eindhoven, Amsterdam in the Netherlands.
All right. And today we have a very special guest. Indra picked our guest for today. Would you care to do an introduction?
I absolutely would love to. So today I am bringing to you Nisse Eimers, and he is my best friend, and we met through the 48, which we will go into a little bit later on. And I thought it would be nice to have a fellow Dutchie on the podcast for once, since we usually just get Americans and the old Frenchman in there. Hi, Olivier. Yeah, a bit more a European flair to the whole thing.
Oh, let's not forget that Wouter was on the show.
So oh, we've had... my bad. Love you, Wouter.
And the show's producer is a Dutch person.
Yes, she is, but she's usually not on as a co-host.
No.
I just have the pleasure today because we're having this on. So yeah, so welcome, Nisse, to our podcast.
Yeah, welcome. It's great to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Great to be.
My pleasure.
This is a lot of fun for me, and it's cool to involve my friends in the stuff that I like to do. So, Nisse, can you start us off by telling us a little bit about yourself and who you are and what you do?
What do you want to know?
Let's start off with, how did you get involved in filmmaking, first of all?
I started studying video editing and camera when I was 16, but I didn't finish that one. I got kicked out. About 2 years later, and then I started acting at some point, and then through acting, I started going back to editing and filming and directing, and now I don't really act and just do the filmmaking part.
Excellent. So, what's your area of specialty? Is it camera department, directing, writing?
Yeah, it's writing, directing. I do edit, and I know how to use a camera, but that's about as far as that goes. No, writing and directing are the things that I focus on the most.
How did you hear about the 48-hour film project, and what role did the 48 play in your development as a filmmaker?
I think I heard about it through a friend of mine who I was at the time in school with, or not in school with anymore because I got kicked out. didn't, but he was making a 48 and he asked me to write it for him. So I did. And then it turned out that the main character I kind of wrote for myself. So, so I asked, could I maybe play the guy?
Mm-hmm.
Then I started acting and through that people started asking if I wanted to be in the 48s, and then at some point, Indra asked me to co-direct with her. So we did that, and that kind of kicked it all off, where I was just like, I'm going to do this shit myself. Did I make the entire thing?
Well, it was kind of funny because we met on the set of a 48 Days film project, which is, for people who do not know, like the big brother, if you will, where in our case, there were four winning teams that made one feature length film, which is called After the Rain. And it was, well, it was made.
Which is an accomplishment. That's an accomplishment, but, you know.
I think it was. So we made the whole thing in 48 days, which was intense, but cool. And that's where we met. And then you acted in one of my 48s and left a toiletry bag on set. And then at one point you came and picked it up at my place. We had coffee, started talking, didn't stop talking since, basically.
Well, you didn't stop.
There we go. I guess I didn't stop talking.
It must be interesting if you're still listening. I mean, that says something right there. Well, it's interesting that you said that, you know, you wrote the part for that 48 and then said, oh, I want to do this for myself. That dovetails nicely out of the last interview with Angela and David, where their motto is, you know, don't wait, create. And so they would write stuff for themselves, or, you know, find like-minded friends who would write something for them. So it seems to be a common theme or practice that runs through, you know, the more successful 48 participants to take the 48 as a springboard, as an opportunity to just not wait and create, to get out there, as David said, get out there and fucking do something.
Yeah, because I think that is, for me, the main thing about 48, and the thing that 48 helped me with. It's just when you're younger and you're just starting out, or you want to start out, but you don't know how, it's like a gateway. It's very easy to get into. It's very easy to force yourself just to make something in 48 hours and get the ball rolling. And if you do that, then you learn so much from just being on set for a certain amount of time, that after that, you start to build the confidence to think like, oh, maybe I can do this outside of a competition, something like that. And I think that what you said about, you know, creating opportunities for yourself and stuff, I think that in this business, that's it, because you can't be dependent on someone seeing you and just going like, yeah, let's use that person, because the chances that that's going to happen are just very, very slim. And they're always going to be very slim. It's like a lucky few who maybe have that. But I can't imagine even they probably worked their asses off to get where they were.
Yeah.
Because I don't, you have to create those opportunities for yourself or you're not going to get them.
And I think that really does roll into, you know, a career past the 48. Can't just sit there and wait for opportunities to roll in. You know, in my, you know, business as an editor, as a post-production person, digital loader, I can't just sit there and wait for jobs to come in. You have to put in the legwork. And, like right now, I'm trying to build more of a digital loader media manager niche for myself. And I'm finding that my post-production circles don't really help in that regard, since it's a camera department job and I spend all my time hanging out with, you know, editors.
Right.
So I can't rely on the network of relationships I've built and word of mouth to get me these kind of jobs that I really enjoy taking. I have to go out and, at the ripe old age of 50, I have to start building kind of a new series of networks.
But don't you think, I mean, you have a very niche thing that you do.
Mm-hmm.
But I know, Nisha, you did quite a lot of acting before you started writing and directing. And as an actor, it's probably even harder, right? Because there's so many of you.
For me, acting, I was very disillusioned by the acting world. When I started out, you know, I really like performing. I still do. I still really like performing, and I'll still act sometimes. If I get asked specifically to do something, and someone asks me, like, "Do you want to be in my film?" Then, and if I read it and I think it's good, I'll still do it because I do like doing it. But the entire thing around acting was absolute worst. the way people treat you in the industry is absolutely horrendous. And for someone who's quite insecure as I am, it's really not good for your mental health. you come into for an audition to some commercial and you come in and they ask you to eat a bag of peanuts and then they look at you very judgingly and they go, "Yeah, thanks." And you leave and they tell you, "No, you didn't get it." You don't know why, you just feel judged and you didn't even do anything. It's not like I got the chance to perform anything. It's just
you ate
like,
a bag of peanuts wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I'm trying to imagine what that looks like, eating a bag of peanuts wrong.
Oh, did you stuff them in your nose or what? Like, what happens if you do that wrong? I don't get it.
It's like that scene in Airplane. Like the drinking problems.
Oh, yeah.
Peanuts you just throw over your shoulder.
I love that. That's so funny.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
Don't call me Shirley. Let me be Frank. Oh, I'm Frank.
Picked a horrible week to stop sniffing glue.
Yeah. People listening, if you haven't seen Airplane, you need to go see it. It's the funniest thing. It's
It could never be made today, but it is So damn funny.
It is still very funny.
Seeing June Cleaver say, "I speak jive." That's
God. And we're done. Yeah. Yeah. It's great. It's, yeah. You should watch it. Absolutely. So, coming back to the 48 a little bit, we co-directed once you want to get rid of me, which I completely understand and want to do by yourself because you're way better by yourself in a lot of things. You will, yeah, I know. He's like shaking his head now, people. So the one 48 that we did together where I produced and you directed and co-wrote all the music for is we made a musical for the 48, right?
Yes, we did.
Wow. Yeah. That's gutsy.
Yeah, and it was very hard.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. There's a reason at the kickoff event when someone draws musical, everyone in the crowd goes, "Oh shit."
Yeah. And the thing was we were really rooting to get horror because when we got horror, because we got horror, but we also got musical. And then we were looking at the thing and we're like, should we? Should we just do both?
Why not?
So we called up our composer and I asked him, are you down to come right now and write all the songs with us and just do the entire thing right now so we can film with already the recording completely done? So we had the timing and everything pre-made. So we didn't sleep at all on Friday. The entire Friday night, we were writing the music, and then in the morning, as soon as all the actors were awake, we recorded all their vocals, and then we went to set and we filmed the entire thing, and then we went to edit. So I didn't sleep at all.
He didn't.
It was very hard, but it was very much fun. It was, I think, my favorite 48 I've ever done.
Wow.
Very high up on my list as well. What he didn't tell you is that he's also a musician, and his co-writer also is, and they write their own music and their own songs. And then together with our composer, Dan Morkens, who is an absolute star.
And by the way, my co-writer is Julian Visse, and he will kill me if I don't say his name again, because once we got an award and I forgot to mention him.
Oh,
Julian, there it is.
Well, let's take the extra step, you know, give me a link to his IMDb or something. We'll put it in the show notes to make sure that, you know, we kind of retroactively help you make up for that grievous mistake of yours.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, but I think the quote unquote lesson to be learned is if you draw a musical on Friday night, it's not impossible. And it's actually a lot of fun. It's hard work. And the right people help. Give it a go. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, but you do really need the team, though, because we were really lucky because we had Dan, our composer, and Thijs, Thijs Boola, our other composer and mixer. And they were so up for it. Like from the get-go, they were really up for it as soon as we called them. And you really need those people. You need those people who are like, a musical sounds impossible, let's do it anyway. And if you don't have those and you have to do it on your own as the writer or whatever, that's going to be really hard.
Because
it's a lot of, I'm really trying not to swear, buddy, because I swear.
You can. Don't worry about it. I fucking
We're
swear
fine.
All the fucking time.
Yes, he fucking does.
Well, you know, drawing a musical and actually choosing to do it is a pretty gutsy move. And even if you don't choose that, it's not an option. It's not one of the genre pairs that you draw. It's still such a good idea to have a composer in your pocket. Like, we work with the Seattle Composers Alliance, and there's some amazing, amazing scoring talent here in Seattle. We have a master's program, the Pacific Northwest Film Scoring Program that runs through the Seattle Film Institute. And whenever we have networking events, I always try to push the composers, who tend to be a very solitary lot, not terribly social. And I'm like, come on, you know, hey, you're a composer. You are a hot commodity here. You know, there's all directors and producers and actors and shooters. But if you find someone that does music, you gotta snatch them up, because it makes all the difference in the world. You know, because when I'm editing something and I'm at the final conform stage and I get the mix back and I lay the mix back with the score in it, that's when it feels real. That's when it feels like a movie to me.
Exactly. I think everyone has that. Every time you finish an edit and this music is not there yet, you're like, oh, this isn't really good, is it? And then the music gets put on and completely opens up.
Yeah, it's when the magic happens.
Exactly. It's
amazing.
Well, I think 2 years ago when we did beta, I think when we saw the edit, we thought it was very funny. It wasn't supposed to be funny, really. And then the music just kind of turned it into...
I'm going to have to defend my own lighting skills. You can... That was definitely fun.
But, okay, so maybe I'm misremembering.
It was a horror movie about giant teddy bear. It was supposed to be funny.
It was horror. Horror is never funny to me. It shouldn't have been.
But the thing was, it ended on such a... What we were worried about in the edit, it ended on such a grim note somewhere. But we made a joke during the grim note. So we thought, that's not really working because it's really, really dark. And then we make a joke and falls flat kind of. But then the music came and the music kind of lifted up the joke and lifted up the grimness. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden the balance was there and it worked. And we thought, see, we can be dark and funny at the same time.
That was exactly the point I was trying to make.
Well, and it's amazing how the music changes the pace a lot. I was teaching an editing class at the Seattle Film Institute, probably 2006, 2007. And one of the graduates of the film scoring program came through, Semi Tureen, fantastic, fantastic composer. And he liked my comedic timing as an editor, because he'd scored something I did a year or two earlier, and he liked that I had a slower edit pace than a lot of the editors that he worked with, because the moment you throw music in, you get the score in, it really does pick up the pace of the film immediately, and you need those gaps for moments to land.
Because I think, like, as an editor, you use rhythm.
Yeah.
Like, when I'm editing, you know, I'm constantly, like, tapping the table to get, like, the rhythm of the scene.
Yep.
And then if you have the rhythm and the composer adds to the rhythm with his own rhythm, then something cool happens, because all of a sudden those long pauses that you had because of the bow rhythm that you had, he starts playing a percussive rhythm that's way faster.
Yeah.
And it gets a completely different vibe. So, I mean, music to me, I love music. Like, music is absolutely my favorite thing on the planet.
Yeah, it really makes such a huge, 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 huge difference. Like, whenever I edit a fight scene, I always throw in a temp track, and I always use Damage Incorporated by Metallica to set the pace for a fight scene. That's
nice.
That's my temp track.
That's so cool.
But yeah, the power of a score is so ridiculous. The effect that music has on moving images, juxtaposed moving images, is amazing. Have either of you ever seen the opening to Saving Private Ryan with the Benny Hill theme song running under it, Yakety Sax? So that gory, bloody, intense, violent opening of the D-Day, the D-Day storming the beach with the theme to Benny Hill, I just laugh uncontrollably at it. The polar opposite reaction you're supposed to have to that.
Laughing a lot about one of the most horrific times in human history. Yeah.
What mind would come up with on a rainy Sunday afternoon and say, let's try it is set on Saving Private Ryan. I will definitely be watching that.
That person is my hero.
it's
insane. You put it under anything and it's funny.
Yeah, that's how much music really changes whatever you see.
Yeah.
I agree. It's super important. And we've had the fortune to work with some really great people on the scores for the films that we made. So how did 48 help you to, like, I'm not sure if establish is the right word, but to get some more done in the industry?
You get to know a lot of people, right? I mean, that's in the beginning, it's like practice. You get used to being on a set. You get used to being under pressure. You get used to making decisions under pressure. And then you know a lot of people because you meet everyone on the team that you've had. Sometimes people for the first time, sometimes you already knew them. And then you meet all the people doing the screenings, doing the awards, whatever. You meet different people. They see your work. They see what they like or don't like. And you start connecting with people that you thought, oh, you have a kind of similar vibe that I kind of dig. So you start having conversations with those people. So I think that everyone I work with now have been people that I've worked with on 48s or known through people I've worked on 48s.
Mm-hmm.
That's where, you know, I also started. That's not completely true. I think I started somewhere on another kind of thing.
The one we shall not name. No, it is. It's so you mean the 1 week, right?
Yeah.
So we have another competition here, and it's called 1 Week Film Project, and they do it's not quite similar, but it is a little bit similar, but they do it in 5 days. And I've also participated on that quite a few times, and so as we said, and so have we together, which is also a great place to make films. Not as great as the 48, obviously, clearly, but yeah. So that's where you go, kind of started off.
Well, that was the first one I did, and then, but with the same guy that I did the first 48 with, Jan van Ooyen, his name is. He's a camera operator. He's very good. He's very good. And I'm still friends with him. And I still work with him sometimes.
I hate saying the networking opportunities are great, because I think there's kind of a, just saying networking minimizes the impact. Because I really do think it's tapping into and becoming part of a community. And obviously you meet a whole ton of 48 participants, but like everyone, we all have friends outside of, you know, and professional acquaintances outside of the 48, and because of the 48.
Wait, sorry, you do? I know.
You will eventually.
Really, Kirk? Really? Yes.
You will have some non 48 friends one of these days.
I have like three.
But yeah, you do. By becoming a part of the 48 community, you are exposed to the larger community in your area and also internationally. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's the important thing. It's not just a networking opportunity. It's a chance to become a part of a vibrant personal and professional community.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the fun thing I think about that community is it contains so many different people with so many different views on things. I mean, I know that I'm very competitive, right? If I did it for you, I wanted to win something, fucking something. And this is the complete opposite. He doesn't. Can I say you don't care?
I think everyone cares a little bit because it's kind of appreciation for something that you did. But I think awards for art is a weird thing that I do not agree with. It's absolutely random on who judges and what's their opinion on something. And it's worth, to me personally, it's worth very little. If someone gives me an award for best writing, I'm flattered that person thinks I did a good job, but it says no, because there's other things that I may have liked way more than mine. And there's other things that other people like way more than mine. So it's, to me, it's pretty meaningless, but that's not just 48. I think that's the Oscars.
Well, yeah, I'm very much of a similar opinion in that You know, I swam competitively at a pretty high level for 10 years. A teammate of mine actually got arrested at the 1988 Olympics.
I need to hear the story at some point.
Yeah, I'll tell this one at a later date. But
bonus episode.
Yeah. So I think I got, you know, a lot of my competitiveness out of me. I think in 10 years of swimming, I won the awards, and swimming was such a, it's a very personal event. It's not as team oriented. So you're really just trying to beat yourself. Granted, yeah, there's other people in the other lanes, but when it comes to creative matters, you know, I try to use, instead of, you know, this is the best movie ever made, substitute it with, this is my favorite movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's not quantifiable really on any measurable scale. You know, objectivity really pervades the arts.
And exactly. You can't objectively call something, some art piece, good or bad. It's weird because it's all.
Oh, I can call it bad if I want to, but you know, I caveat that with, I think this is terrible because.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Opinions are okay. Yeah, that's fine.
But does it change the way you? I mean, it's a 48-hour project podcast, so I'm going to come back to that. Does it change the way you make your 48 films? Is there a different mindset going into it?
I think so, because one time, me and Julian, we wrote something with the 48 in mind. One time we thought, okay, let's write something that we know they want to see. And it worked. Like, we won. So I guess that to me shows how ridiculous it is, because that's, no, what's the point? So it normally I just write, or we just write what makes us laugh or what makes us afraid, and or, you know, what excites us. That's what we do. Because we really want to see it. And I think if you start doing it to fill those things that you think the audience might want to see, or the 48 judges might want to see, you can win. But yeah, it's not that fulfilling to me. I just like going, yeah, okay, I kind of expected that, because we kind of touched on all the things that always wins. So it feels a bit empty to me.
Oh, over here, yeah. There's a very big tendency that funny things win.
That's very similar to here. Yeah,
probably completely different over there in the States.
No, like, not at all. Well, it's going to vary wildly by region, because the United States is definitely not monolithic. I mean, even so, we have Portland, Oregon, just 3 hours to the south, and I love Portland. I've always enjoyed Portland as a city. I love visiting it. And my wife grew up there, and so we're there pretty frequently. But their films are so much fucking weirder than ours. They're just 3 hours to the south. They're part of the Pacific Northwest. You know, we're brethren. But yeah, their films are so odd. Some of the strangest 48s I've ever seen have come out of Portland, and they win in Portland. But you come up to Seattle, and our best performing film ever at Filmapalooza was our 2014 winner from Team Challenge Accepted, a film called I, Charon, which is a comedy, and it's a fantastic film. It deserved everything it got.
Definitely.
But it's not just crazy over the top weird like a lot of Portland films are. And then you see, you know, because we have events in Kentucky and Tennessee and Texas and Louisiana and Florida, and even within, you know, just Florida, you're going to see a huge difference between Miami and Orlando, which are just a couple hours apart. So the United States it's really strangely diverse.
I think you kind of said something. You said it's only a couple of hours apart. That's the entire country here.
Like, yeah,
we can go from one side of the country to the other in 3 hours. So there's not room for diversity.
Yeah. I always like to say, like, if I want to go visit my brother in Montana, my brother and his family, it's the equivalent of driving from Paris to Berlin.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's technically two states over. So I drive through basically all of Washington, And then there's this weird little panhandle part in the north of Idaho where you drive through about 100 kilometers of Idaho and then you're in Montana. So it's a little over 800 kilometers from my house to my brother's doorstep. And that's, this is in the same country. And that's only one quarter of the distance, like, across the country. It's a big damn place.
And we're a very tiny place. So
yeah. Yeah.
We're a very tiny place.
Yes. But, you know, within the 48 community, you know, the Dutch have a reputation of creating some of the, I don't want to say best,
Some of
the most highly awarded and regarded films. And I think rightly so. I look forward to every Dutch film I see at Filmapalooza every year, because there does seem to be an attention to storycraft that I think can be missing in a lot of American cities.
Maybe. I don't know if this is true. This is just me speculating. But the film industry in the States is huge. And there's so many different opportunities, even on a lower level, to have in the States. We have, like, almost none. So that means that a lot of talented people who are really good at what they do never really get the chance to do it on the highest level. Mm-hmm. So I think that's probably why a lot of these amateur things gets a lot of talent, because that talent has to do something with their creativity. So they do these kind of things.
Interesting.
I think that is definitely a problem. When I see, like, the amount of films and the amount of shows that we bring out is, well, quite honestly, a bit embarrassing sometimes.
Yeah.
Especially if you compare it to, like, Belgium, which are our neighbors, Germany, also our neighbors. They bring out, like, amazing movies and amazing shows. And we have, like, almost shit show.
Yeah.
We have almost none. And that means that a lot of talent just goes somewhere else and they start doing things by themselves, or you get like Reuter Reutemann, who goes and film for Nolan because he can't get a job here, and you get Paul Verhoeven, who moves to the States because he can't get a film off the ground here. And, you know, you get,
we're grateful for that. Oh my god, I can't imagine life without RoboCop.
Exactly right. And imagine if we had
Starship Troopers.
RoboCop. You guys have RoboCop. It's horrible. But that, I think that's definitely a problem that we have in this country. And I think it is, I'm hopeful that it's starting to change with, like, streaming getting bigger and getting more international, that a lot of streaming services are
Norway is blowing up in terms of streaming content. There's so much good, like, detective dramas coming out of Norway.
It's funny because, I mean, when we have coffee, we talk about film and music and the, you know, the world that film and music film. And then we were discussing it the other week, right? When we spoke about what Netflix is bringing out from individual countries, and the like Nisa said, the difference of quality. If you get the Dark from Germany, which is amazing. You get Rain from Denmark, and then I won't even name what you know, the Dutch people brought. And I've always said there's so much more talent in the 48 layer of the film industry over here than there is at the top layer. And it's a shame that people with interesting vision, bar the romantic comedies that we tend to produced by the masses, are not getting a chance over here. It's a shame.
But I think there's a lot of talent also at the top level, but studios just only green light the same movie like 20 times in a row.
Yeah.
It's the same romantic comedy, as you said. It's the same war movie again. And then if they do something for Netflix, they do something that is exactly the same as they've been doing on Dutch television, just like a crime drama, but Dutch. That means a lot of nudity and mostly about drugs. And it's always the same thing. And it doesn't really take any chances. And when they do take chances, they take half-assed chances and it flops. And then they go, see, it didn't work. We'll go back to the old formula. But just if you actually took the chance and if you actually put people there and gave them the money to do what they wanted to do, it would have probably worked.
So if they gave you the money, what would you make?
I think that we lack genre films in general. In over here in the Netherlands, we have, well, there's this new Netflix movie out now, but it's more a kid movie like Captain Nova or something. I haven't seen it yet. But that's promising that that came out. But we have like Paul Vu, for example, is a genre director, or he became a genre director.
Mm-hmm.
But the only things he got made here were war movies and crime dramas about sex and drugs. And then he moved to other places and he did all this cool stuff like Starship Troopers, RoboCop shit. But the same goes for Dick Maas. Dick Maas is also a Dutch director. I'm not a huge fan, but he does make horror movies. That's his thing. And even he, even though he's had a career since like the late 70s or something, because he made like Amsterdam or something.
Yes, it is. Good one, right? It's so funny.
and even he now has to finance his own horror movies to get them to show in the cinemas. And that's something that we here as a country just do not fund at all. Any genre movie, anything that just is a bit off kilter, a bit weird, it doesn't really get funded. We have a lot of really good like indie movies.
Mm.
We have a lot of those, but well, they don't even get screened anyway.
Yeah, it's a problem very similar to what we have here in, I can't say just Seattle, but Washington State in general, in that, well, we have Vancouver to the north, and there's no way for us to directly compete with Vancouver because the industry there is so massive. You know, I mean, the CW network like owns Vancouver. So there's lots of mopey rich kids starring CW dramas, but that's also, you know, where all the Stargate stuff and Psych and a lot of stuff was shot and movies like crazy. But then we have, like I said, Portland to the south, and they're in Oregon, and their film incentive for years has been way bigger than Washington's. So we constantly have this talent drain of, if someone still wants to live in the Pacific Northwest and work in the industry, they move to Portland.
Right.
Because they've got 5 TV shows going and they've got numerous feature films going every year. Or if someone's more ambitious, they'll pick up and move to Los Angeles or to Atlanta. And I mean, Atlanta has blown up in the last 12 years. It's just, it's unbelievable what's happened in Georgia. It's right. Crazy. And then just in 2019, Montana to our east, they started their film incentive at 3 times the size of Washington's. And Montana is a gigantic state. It is huge. And there's only about 1 million people in it. So population wise, this huge state with just, it's gorgeous. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous state.
One day.
Yeah. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous state, but they're having to import a ton of people. Like the show Yellowstone shoots there, and they have to bring a ton of people in from LA to fill out a lot of the positions. But slowly but surely, they're building up the crew base in the state. And there's a lot of people who are now making their living working in the industry. And we're hoping that that happens here in Washington, because we just increased our film incentive fourfold. So it went from $3.5 million to $15 million. So we're hoping that will employ a lot more people.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because our dear friend Chris from Toronto was saying, you know, there's always kind of a way to make some money in this industry.
Yeah.
Of either being it on, you know, television or film sets or working for a smaller production company, which is what you're doing at the moment, right?
Yes. Yeah. I work with one of our other best friends. Kaylee Meyer, she has her own production company called OK Media, and also another one called OK Studios. And
we, nice little plug there.
Plug in. and we make like mostly corporate stuff now, but we're trying to, with OK Studios, the new label, we're trying to like branch out into more also music videos and stuff that's a bit more cinematic and story driven, because we're, you know, we met as storytellers on fiction films. So
where did you meet her again?
On Glenmuir film set.
Which was for?
40.
Hey!
we are shameless about plugging the 48. Shameless. We have
this is the official 48-hour film project podcast. What do you want?
I'm wearing my new 48-hour film project San Francisco t-shirt right now.
I'm glad you actually said it this time. Usually he just shows it and forgets this is not a visual thing. He was holding up a pen the other day. Look at this. I'm like, okay, people, he's holding up a pen now.
I'm doing it again.
There's the pen again.
The tattoo Bob pen.
The tattoo Bob pen, yeah. Funny.
I think there's a lot of parallels between what you experience in the Netherlands in terms of building a career in filmmaking and what we experience here in Washington State. Even though we're in the United States, our existence as filmmakers, as storytellers, it's a far more difficult journey than, say, if you picked up and moved to London or Paris or Berlin. There's different opportunities available. And if I picked up and moved to LA or to Atlanta or New York, but you can carve out a living. You know, I love the Pacific Northwest. I love living here. And that's why I do. I've made, you know, the best friends of my life here. That's not to discount, you know, my friends that I've stayed with, you know, since high school and grade school or anything. But I love you, Chris Charger. Hello. And Chris Charger and Pat. I met my wife here. We bought a house here, and Kasia has a career here that she loves. And I could never say, hey, I want to pick up and move to LA and edit horror features because that would be incredibly selfish and, you know, a huge risk. But I make a living here in Seattle. It's rare that I work on any nonfiction narrative. Like, I'm working on a project for Microsoft right now. And I'm using the skills I've learned as an editor, as a storyteller, to make a living. And I'm more happy about living here and using my skills than I am about making it as a nonfiction narrative editor. I think there are corollaries.
I think there definitely are. And I think because I spend most of my time now writing commercial scripts and stuff like that. And I think it really helps me to understand narrative structure and understand how storytelling works. It can sometimes get frustrating because you kind of have to stay within the lines.
Yeah.
Especially like someone you make something for, they read it and they go, no, we want to change that. And then you go, but it doesn't work anymore if you do that, but okay, guess we're going to change it.
There was a producer I worked with. We did lots of auto dealership commercials, and I was still in my 30s and had opinions on things. And
you still have those now.
I do, but more on things that are of my own creation. But when I'm working for a client, I'm going to try and give them, you know, what they need out of a project as much as I'm going to give them what they want. And this producer, John Polnick, I'll never forget when you told me this, is sometimes you have to install the toilet in the kitchen because that's what the client wants.
Exactly. Yeah. That's absolutely true. It happens so many times that think this is not going to be great, but that is what you want. Then that is
it. You're writing the check. Okay. If you want the toilet in the kitchen, you get the toilet in the kitchen.
Exactly.
That's hilarious. I'm going to use that. I'm going to
Oh, yeah. It's a great one. You know, John Polnick, thank you for that. I really appreciate it. It's informed my professional worldview ever since you told me that in 2009. Yeah. So, Nyssa, what's going on for you right now? And what are your near and long-term plans?
Oh, well, I'm working now for OK Studios Locomedia, as I just said. And I'm still doing that. and I'm going to be doing that. But I'm also, me and Julian Wissem, my writing partner, and he's also my musical partner. We are trying to get some projects off the ground, get some scripts written, and we're releasing our first EP.
Nice.
Releasing our first EP that we've just finished, and it's now getting mixed.
And he's not going to say this, but they're amazing. They're really, really, really good. And I'm not just saying this because it's him, but they're absolutely smashing.
Excellent. Yeah. What's the name and where will we be able to find it?
Well, you'll be able to find it on anything like Spotify, YouTube, what, Apple Music. Is that still a thing?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, it's still a thing. There's at least one subscriber in me, so.
Well, there you go. Our band is called Which One Am I Again? That's the band. And
sounds like an improv group.
Exactly. Well, you understood straight away. Normally, when I say this to people over here in the Netherlands, they go like, what? What? What was that? I have to spell it out and stuff. But yeah, you can find us on anything. And the EP is coming out, I think, it's now May. It's probably coming out in June.
Oh, cool.
Releasing. There's one single on there now, but that is...
We'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah. But that is a bit of an older song because we released one song, then like pandemic hit and we were all locked in and did nothing. So we wrote a lot and then we recorded this album that's coming out.
So tell the people what type of music you guys make.
Shut up. You know I hate that question.
I'm sorry, I couldn't resist.
I want it to be like death metal or something. A death metal band called Which One Am I Again?
No, we make like, I don't know what it is. It's like spacey post-rock stoner metal thing.
With soul, with a lot of feeling in the lyrics and his vocals and the music. It's really, really beautiful.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing it because that description pushes a couple of my musical buttons. So a
couple of buttons, yeah. Yeah. That's why I just say a lot of things. And there's always something.
Clever.
I do like sludgy, stonery stuff. Like, you know, the Melvins and Sleep and Caius. And
I'll sleep.
Well, Nissa, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Gary, thank you for having me. So, good noise.
Indra, thank you for introducing us.
My pleasure. This was a lot of fun.
Oh, definitely. We'll have to do it again.
Oh, for sure.
Right. Oh, yeah, sure.
All right. Until next time, everyone, enjoy.
48 hours to go. If you're looking for a hero, then this is the show. Where did they come from? What do they know? It's an origin story. Let's go.
48 Hour Heroes Origin Stories is a production of Media Without Borders, the Seattle 48 Hour Film Project, and Heads Up Productions.